Offering my most loving pranams at Bhagwan's lotus feet. Dear listeners, I welcome you to this week's episode of the Gita series, A Triune Pilgrimage. This is Prem, and it gives me great pleasure to join you again on this beautiful Thursday morning from our studios at the Shri Satya Sai Media Center, Prashanthi Nilayam. Even as we reach out to you live, we hope that each one of you is keeping well and keeping safe by Swami's grace. And we all are doing well. A lot of people have been asking. We are, all of us here at the Shri Satya Sai Media Center are keeping well by Swami's grace. And I'm here to continue with the program that we've been doing week after week. Last week we took a break. I played for you a talk that I had given on the Ramayana. And today I'm back to go back to the Dwapara Yuga, where Krishna is speaking to Arjuna on the battlefield. We are in the ninth chapter of this beautiful work, the Bhagavad Gita, and as always, it is a pleasure to do it along with you. And even as we go through the Bhagavad Gita, the opportunity to go through Swami's Gita Vahini and understand the true import of the message that Lord Krishna is giving Arjuna and through Arjuna, each one of us. The last time around, that is a couple of weeks back, I spent almost the entire episode talking about just one shloka, the 26th shloka of the 9th chapter. And as I mentioned multiple times, it is again one of the shlokas that Swami has spoken extensively about. Swami has quoted multiple times during his discourses, and that's why it warranted us to give it that kind of time and go through all the various interpretations that are given for that shloka. As a quick summary of what we covered last time, and also it's going to be the basis for the couple of shlokas or a few more that we will be seeing today. So going back to the 26th shloka, one of the interpretations of the shloka, the contextual one, is that you can offer in worship anything to the Lord. It could be patram, a leaf, pushpam, a flower, phalam, a fruit, or toyam, water. So it doesn't matter what you offer. It could be something as simple as these four. That is the contextual idea of that shloka. And we had discussed how this explains why we refer to God as Sulabha Prasanna, the one who is easily pleased. Because the wherewithal to please him is available even to a child, even to a pauper, even to a person who is decrepit. Then there is the deeper significance to the statement that we looked at. Swami says in a discourse, and I read out that portion last time, where he says, you imagine that you can give something that is worldly, something that's trivial, and then attain in return a gift that is supreme, that is spiritual, right? Swami says it doesn't work that way. What you offer should be equal in value to what you expect in return. That is why Swami says you cannot take patram, pushpam, phalam and toyam in that literal sense. Then we went on to discuss the most important interpretation that Swami gives multiple times again whenever Swami has spoken about this shloka. This is the interpretation that Swami gives. Swami says patram or leaf represents the human body, the physical body itself is the patram that has to be offered to the Lord. And we saw what is the inner significance of this, because body is the basis for all the actions that we perform, the duty that we dispense, even the devotional actions that we do, the sadhana that we perform. For all of that, the physical body is the basis. Just like when you traditionally offer naivedyam or any kind of offering, food offering to the Lord at the end of a puja, they lay out a leaf and on that leaf, the other offerings are placed. So in that sense, when Swami says the leaf is the body is the basis for all other offerings that we can make to the Lord. Pushpam, Swami says, is the Hridaya Pushpam, the flower of the heart. What makes even a mundane action a spiritual one? It is nothing but the feeling in the heart. It is the heart that makes an act spiritual. Swami would often play with the words artificial and heartificial. Swami would say that all that you do for the Lord should come from the heart. And that's the symbolism that is expressed when during pujas, when they do an archana, right? When they take the different names of the Lord, or they say that I would like to offer this to you, my Lord, and they would take a flower and place it in front of the deity. The idea of the flower is, this is the act that I'm doing and I'm putting my feelings of my heart in that, right? So the pushpam that has to be offered to the Lord, Swami says, is the Hridaya Pushpam. Then comes phalam, the fruit. Swami says the fruit that has to be offered is manophalam, the fruit of the mind. We had discussed how the mind is actually the place where the final result or final fruit of any action is reflected. When you perform any action and then you have your feeling attached to that action, that results as an adrishta phalam, the unseen fruit in the mind. It either becomes a vasana, if the action is not noble, it becomes a sanskara, if it is a noble act, right? So the result for any act that is performed, the fruit is actually in the mind. So when Swami says the mano phalam that has to be offered, what has to be offered to the Lord is the transformation that happens in this process of becoming a devotee of the Lord and offering devotional service, right? That transformation is what is referred to as manophalam. Finally, toyam, water. Swami says it is not any water, it is not water from the rivers, it is not water from the five sacred rivers or three sacred rivers or from the place where three sacred rivers come together, the Triveni. No, the toyam that has to be offered to the Lord, Swami says, is the tears that come moved by devotion, right? It could be ananda bhashpam, the tears of bliss that a devotee sheds listening to about the Lord or thinking about the Lord, or it could even be tears of yearning. But no offering is greater, no offering of water is greater than these tears that are shed. The last time I wanted to make a reference to a very beautiful episode that happens in the Srimad Bhagavatam with regards to this yearning for the Lord, right? Crying for the Lord. We all know about the Rasa Leela, one of the most beautiful episodes from the childhood of Lord Krishna before he moves to Mathura, right? The Rasa Leela or Rasa Krida. But before the Rasa Leela happens, there is this episode where all the Gopikas have assembled on the banks of Yamuna. Krishna is also there. And when at a time they all are very happy that they've had this opportunity to come and be with Krishna, it's a beautiful full moon night and they are having this opportunity to congregate with their sweet Lord. But all of a sudden, Krishna vanishes from their sides. And Sukamarshi writes how the Gopikas start crying. They lose their sense of balance. They start running from tree to tree and asking the creepers and the leaves and the flowers. They say, have you seen our Krishna? He was with us. He's not with us now. They run from every plant and bush and tree and ask them as though they are friends, and they address them as friends and says, have you seen our Krishna? He is not in our midst. Probably Krishna gives them a glimpse of the separation that they were going to endure, because very shortly after this evening, the rest of the events of Krishna's life start unfolding. Probably it was a moment of that yearning and that separation that they were going to endure. But the story goes that not able to find Krishna, all the Gopikas then come and sit down and they start talking about Krishna. They start recollecting leelas that Krishna would do as a child. They start singing about Krishna. And I think that portion of the Bhagavatam is what is referred to as Gopika Geetam, I think, right? Where they all start reminiscing about Krishna's childhood and all the pranks that he would play and all the miracles that he had performed and all of that. And even as they're doing that, after a while, Krishna again appears in their midst, and then ensues this very beautiful and profound and important conversation. One of the things that Krishna tells during that exchange is, he says, it may appear that sometimes I don't respond to devotion, but that is never true. Krishna says, I always love, but I sometimes keep away only so that your craving for me increases. Right? He says, I left you all and went and you were all crying, and when you were crying, it didn't seem like I was coming back. It is not that I don't respond to love. I don't respond to anything the way I respond to love. I always respond to love. But sometimes I keep away only so that you will crave for me, you will shed tears for me. And then Krishna says, when I was away, I was also noticing what you were doing in my absence. And he said, even in my absence, you were all only thinking of me and you were all only craving for me. And Krishna says, I am so pleased. I am so moved by the devotion that you all have for me. So when we choose to shed tears only for God, when we crave, it may appear that God is being heartless. He is allowing us to cry. He is allowing the separation to continue. It may appear that, Swami, you're not being Sulabha Prasanna because you don't seem to be easily pleased. But even in that apparent heartless gesture, what Swami is doing is nothing but deepening our love for Him. Then Krishna says, I have pained you by going away, but don't get upset with me. You gave up all your bonds and came to me, and I can never repay my obligation to such love that you have shown to me. And so saying, Krishna begins the Rasa Krida. When you seek Swami's love, the only prize that is equivalent to that love that we seek from Him is the love that we have, isn't it? That's the only thing. When Swami said, what you seek, what you offer should be equal in value to what you seek. If you seek His love, the only thing that is close to any value of that love is the love that we have in our hearts. So Krishna beautifully says there, you have shown me such love that nothing in the world is equal to it. So now I am forced to give myself to you. Right? That is the Rasa Krida. That is what Rasa Krida stands for. The one Lord becomes a Krishna each for each Gopika. Because Krishna says, you have shown me such love, in response to that, I can give only myself. And then the Rasa Leela happens. So when with such love we offer patram, pushpam, phalam, toyam, our own physical body, the hridaya pushpam, the manophalam, the ananda bhashpam, as Krishna said, madhyajinaha mam yanti. When you worship me, you reach me. Why? Because the only worthy gift in return for such pure love is pure love itself, and He is that pure love embodied. Before we move to the next shloka, I will just read out one final dialogue from the Ramakatha Raswaini. I read out a few last time around too. The idea of offering, what do you offer? What is it that you actually offer? When Mother Shabari offers Rama the fruits, we all know how she offers them. You know, she picks each fruit, she tastes them, and she finds, she certifies which fruit is sweet enough to be offered to the Lord, and only those fruits she offered, right? And when she offers such fruits, Rama relishes those fruits, and then he tells her a very beautiful dialogue, which Swami writes. Swami writes, these are Rama's words. He says, Mother, these fruits are as sweet as your own heart. Really, these are not fruits that grow on trees. Why? The wild fruits that grow in jungles are not so sweet at all. They can never be. These are fruits that have grown on the holy tree of life, on the branches of the pure mind, in the sunshine of love. So here is Lord Rama describing what is the offering that Mother Shabari was making. She was not giving a fruit, she was not giving a tasted fruit, a juta, as we call in Hindi, right? That's not what she was offering. She was not giving something that she had defiled by her own tasting. What she was actually offering was the fruits that have grown on a life that have been led in a holy manner, on the branches of a purified mind, in the sunshine of love. When such love is offered to the Lord, can the Lord satisfy the devotee, even if he were to offer the entire world, or for that matter, all the worlds and all the luxuries? No, you cannot satisfy a devotee like that. So the Lord is bound to offer himself and himself alone, right? So that's the essence of this portion of the Gita, and this continues, as I said, the theme continues. The next one, the 27th shloka, again is a very beautiful shloka, summarizes whatever Krishna has been telling, a mantra for life, defines how we must lead our life in a spiritual journey. We listen to the 27th shloka of the 9th chapter, again rendered beautifully in the voice of Brother Shyam. We listen to it, I'll give you a brief meaning of that, and then we'll discuss in detail what Krishna conveys there.
Yat karoshi yadashnasi yat juhoshi dadasi yat yat tapasyasi kaunteya tat kurushva madarpanam.
Whatever you do, whatever you eat, whatever you offer, whatever you give away, whatever austerity you may practice, O Arjuna, do that as an offering to me. So that is the 27th verse of the 9th chapter. As I said, very beautiful verse. In the 25th shloka, Krishna had said, those who worship me, reach me. And in the next shloka, he explained what to offer. Right? That's what I was speaking about in the summary. Though we went through it in detail, what he said was quite cryptic. He simply said flower, leaf, fruit and water. But when we dwell into it, we understand essence is only the feeling, right? What makes any of these offerings what they are is that feeling behind that offering. What you offer doesn't matter. With what feeling you offer is all that matters. That being the case, does any process matter at all? As we had discussed a few weeks back, what Krishna is referring to here is a stage where upasana is not a karma towards yoga kshema. That is, prayer or worship is not just another action towards self-welfare. I want this, I want that, so I perform actions, and so I also pray. Right? This is the stage of a worldly person. But here Krishna is speaking of a state where you are a upasaka, a worshipper. I do upasana or prayer through, say, whatever is referred to as samanya bhakti, using the methods such as shravanam, kirtanam, smaranam and so on. But I don't stop with that. Whatever action I perform, I do that also as a form of worship. Every devotional activity must permeate into our regular activities, right? That's the essence of Karma Yoga itself. The ultimate expression of that is doing every action as prayer, doing every karma as upasana. And as we've seen in the Gita earlier too, what is an expression of a higher state of wisdom that can be taken and it can be used as a practice, or it can be used as a sadhana, to eventually reach that state. So using the same idea, Krishna defines what can be done as puja, right? What can be used as a process of worship. He said, if you worship deities, you reach them. There is a procedure for that, maybe a certain kind of yajna, a certain kind of vrata. He said, if you worship pitrus, you reach their loka. For that again, there is a method, a certain set of rites and rules. So now he says, what are the rituals or rites by which you can worship him? What is the process by which you can worship him and eventually reach him? What are they? Yat karoshi, whatever you do. Yat ashnasi, whatever you eat. Yat juhoshi, whatever you offer in sacrifices, or in general, whatever you offer in worship. Dadasi yat, whatever you may give. Yat tapasyasi, whatever you practice as austerity. Kaunteya, O Arjuna, tat, that itself. Kurushva madarpanam, do as an offering unto me. Tat kurushva madarpanam, that itself, make it as an offering to me. What a beautiful verse. Krishna says, yat karoshi, whatever you do, you may be a teacher, a homemaker, a doctor, a truck driver, a cashier, a watchman, a minister, a soldier, a judge, name it. Tat karoshi, whatever you do, madarpanam, tat kurushva madarpanam, do it as an offering to me. Yat ashnasi, whatever you eat, you don't have to make a royal feast for me. You don't have to separately cook for me. You know, we will eat pizzas and burgers, but for Swami we'll keep fruits and water, because that's what Krishna said in the Gita, right? It's not like that. He says, whatever you eat, whether it is a humble gruel or a feast, offer it to me. And that's the idea behind chanting Brahmarpanam, isn't it? Yat juhoshi, whatever form of worship or yajna you do. Traditionally, each family line in Sanatana Dharma would have a different kind of a yajna that is being performed, right? If you were to look at it from today's modern context, you may be a Muslim who is observing Ramzan fast, or you may be a Hindu performing Amavasya or Ekadasi Vratam, or maybe you're an Christian who is observing the Lent. It doesn't matter at all. Yat juhoshi, whatever form of worship or yajna you do, offer it to me. Dadasi yat, whatever you give, it could be food to the hungry, water to the thirsty, or you may be very well endowed and you're able to build a super speciality hospital to the poor. Believe that you're offering it to me. Dadasi yat, whatever you may be offering, offer it to me. Yat tapasyasi. Here, tapas, we could say, stand for any kind of sadhana, right? Because Swami would say real tapas is unity of thought, word, and deed. And every sadhana that we perform is actually to attain this unity of thought, word, and deed. So he says, yat tapasyasi. Whatever form of sadhana you take, I'm into likitanama japam, it doesn't matter. I'm into doing bhajans, why not? I am into doing meditation in the early morning hours. Yat tapasyasi, whatever sadhana you may be performing, offer it to me. And when you look at these instructions, you cannot do this if you don't have love, isn't it? Why will I offer everything I do to one particular person? I will do it only when I have love for that person, isn't it? In fact, we all are capable of this attitude. Many of you listeners who may be parents, probably you will be able to relate to it better. Look at your own lives. How effortlessly you do everything that you do for the welfare of your children, right? Some of you may be doing two jobs. Some of you may be putting up with irrational bosses because you need to keep your job. You may yourself be going hungry sometimes, right? You do all that because you have love for your children, right? Without any effort, without any force on yourself, naturally, you're able to do that because you have love. That's the power of love. Such love has to be directed towards Swami. Many times in discourses when Swami would speak of the Navaveda Bhakti and come to the path of Archanam, right? We all know Shravanam, Kirtanam, Smaranam, Padasevanam, Vandanam and Archanam. When Swami comes to Archanam, Swami would quote the previous shloka that we had spoken about, the Patram Pushpam Palam Toyam. This shloka can be seen as a clear continuation of that, right? Swami would speak of offering Patram Pushpam Palam Toyam. Though Krishna says here, offer anything to me, think of yourself. Think of this for yourself, right? Swami is in front of you. Swami says you can offer anything to me. But does that mean that we will indiscriminately offer anything to Swami, even though Swami says, give me anything that you want? Will we not keep asking ourselves, is this worthy of being offered to Swami? I think that's why I often would think when you talk of Archanam as offering all this to Swami and making all your actions and deeds and whatever you do and whatever you give and whatever you perform as sadhana, everything as an offering, Archanam will automatically lead us to Dasyam. Archanam is making an offering of whatever you do. Dasyam is when you do whatever only pleases the Lord. So Archanam is a stage where automatically it is going to take you to that stage of Dasyam, because you will keep asking yourself, can I offer this to God? I'm eating something. Can I make an offering of this to Swami? I can't. So let me not eat this. I am doing this. Can I make an offering of this to Swami? Probably Swami will not be pleased with what I'm doing, right? So this self-analysis will, without our knowledge, push us from Archanam to Dasyam, where we'll automatically look at our lives and examine it and say that, okay, I can't do these things. These don't please Swami. I cannot do this because I cannot offer these things to Swami, right? Some of you regular listeners will know, or follow most of our programs, will know the beautiful conversation that we had with one of Swami's devotees, Miss Charu Sinha. She's an IPS officer. I think we had done this interview sometime in 2010. If I'm not wrong, sometime last year we got the news that she has been posted as the Inspector General of CRPF, the Central Reserve Police Force in Srinagar, right? It's supposed to be one of the most sensitive postings for an IPS officer in India. And she was the first lady officer to be given that very, very sensitive posting, right? IG of CRPF Srinagar. And this was in 2010. I'm not too sure if she has moved on or if she's still having that posting. When we did the conversation in 2010, she was the Director General of Police for the Anantapur range, in which Puttaparthi also comes. Just before I come to the point I'm trying to make, the reference I'm trying to make from that interview that we had with her, I'll just give you a little bit of the background to give you the idea that it'll better convey what I'm trying to convey when I quote that portion. Her association with Swami predates, and I think sometime around 1989 was the first time she and her family come to Swami. Sometime in 1996, when she was preparing for civil service exams and was in the process of giving those exams, Swami comes to her in a dream and Swami tells her, because you are very strong and capable, I am going to select you for protecting something, right? Swami says this. She doesn't know what that means, but 6 months down the line, she was selected to the IPS, the Indian Police Service. And she says that all through the grueling 2 years of police training, she was not an athlete, she was not she was a very shy Indian girl. So she was not really prepared for that police training. Very, very rigorous cross-country running and push-ups and front rolls and back rolls and all of that. She was not ready for that. She was telling how she went through that entire period because of this one thought that Swami came to her in a dream, and Swami told her that I am entrusting you this duty, because she felt this was a role that Swami has given to her and she cannot turn away from it. So she said that all through those training, through the bruises and the fractures that she had to endure, she would say that even as she would run, the 5-kilometer run, 10-kilometer run, she would keep chanting Baba, 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 or Om Shri Sai Ram, Om Shri Sai Ram, thinking of Swami. And that's how she, you know, kind of got through that period. And thereafter, when she got her postings and she was facing the many challenges that a police officer goes through, especially a woman police officer, Swami was constantly guiding her as to how to deal with these various challenges that were coming up in her life. She was saying that initially she would take, and this is the point I wanted to quote, right? She was saying that initially she would struggle with decision making. Because being a police officer, the decisions that you take, the actions that you undertake, have very serious implications on people's lives, right? It could even mean life or death sometimes. So she would take a lot of time to make such critical decisions, and that was not the right way to go about her job because it called her to take swift decisions and she couldn't endlessly deliberate. So again, in one of the guidances she gets from Swami, Swami tells her, look, you're taking too long to make decisions. You should be making decisions more swiftly. And I think she says, Swami, I don't know how to make decisions, and because these are decisions that are going to influence and impact people's lives. And Swami gives her this instruction. Swami says, see, whatever you do, whatever decisions you take, whatever you are, whatever actions that you have to do in the course of your duty, you do it as an offering to me. You just offer it to me. When you take a decision, if the decision is right, it will go the right way, nothing to worry. If it so happens that the decision that you have taken is wrong, Swami said, when you have offered it to me, I will ensure that the result is not so wrong. Swami says, if the decision is right, then no worries. The results are going to go on as expected. But if you happen to take a wrong decision, Swami says, don't worry. I will ensure that the impact of that wrong decision is least and you will be able to make amends. So you go ahead and take the decision. And thereafter, she said that she started, she was able to take very quick decisions and very smart decisions. But what a beautiful assurance, isn't it? Because we all have this fear. You know, it's very easy to mentally say, Swami, I offer it to you. But we are worried about the decisions that we make. What if I make a wrong decision and I offer it to Swami? Does that make it right? Right? But Swami is giving the assurance here. If you happen to take a wrong decision after having offered it to me, don't worry. I will ensure that the impact is least. Right? And it's all a learning process. And if you look at it, not just in Dwapar Yuga, that Krishna was teaching a warrior how to perform his duties as a devotional offering. Even in this Kali age, Swami was guiding people like Ms. Charu Sinha, right? Playing similar roles. They are the Kshatriyas of the modern age. They are the ones who have to go out and sometimes take to the tool of violence in the cause of protecting us, right? So even to the Arjunas of the modern days, the warriors of the modern days, Swami is giving the same message and it is applicable even to that life, even to this age. In that beautiful conversation, she speaks of the various kinds of criminals that she has to deal with, right? And you cannot be soft with them. You cannot be kind to them all the time. You have to be dealing with them firmly. But then she says how Swami teaches her, even in this job, you can see, even this job can be seen as Swami's work, and every act can and must be offered to Swami. And in the process, Swami teaches her how every act eventually becomes perfect, right? How the way she deals with criminals changes, the way she handles crooked seniors and people in authority changes. And before long, she finds that every teaching of Swami comes to influence her decisions and her actions even before it can be offered to Swami, right? And before long, she realizes that she is precisely doing what Swami would expect her to do. That's what I said. From Archanam, seamlessly, effortlessly, we will progress to the stage of Dasyam, where every act that we do will be in accordance to Swami's command. In his conversation with Hislop, Swami makes a very beautiful statement. He says, if every action is done for Sai, then Sai will be added to every action, and Sai will bring success with that action. If every action is with Sai, then the actor is with Sai. The actor will then not be different from Sai. He will be Sai. What a beautiful statement. The path to sublimation of doership is laid out by this act of offering everything to Swami. And this can be done in every profession, every field of life, because end of the day, we all have preferences. We are governed by our conditioning over many births. We have our raga and dvesha, likes and dislikes, specific interests. That's what makes each one of us unique. That's what makes me do what I'm doing. That's what makes you do what you're doing, right? That's what has made us all unique. So when Krishna says, whatever you do, whatever you eat, however you pray, whatever you offer, whatever you give, whatever you do in charity, you can offer all of that to me. It means it is an opportunity to progress in this path towards the supreme goal from wherever we are, in whatever makeup we are in. There is no precondition other than love. Whatever you offer, offer it with love. Whatever you do, do it with love. With love, offer anything. And Krishna says, I will accept it. Right? What happens when we are able to live life like this? As I said, Archaram will lead to Dasyam and then life transforms. But what then? What happens in to us when we lead our life like this? And that Krishna mentions in the next shloka. We listen to the 28th shloka of the 9th chapter.
Shubha shubha phalai revam mokshyase karma bandhanai sanyasa yoga yuktatma vimukto mamu paishyasi.
Thus you will become free from bondage in the form of actions which are productive of good and bad results. Having your mind imbued with the yoga of renunciation and becoming free, you will then attain me. That's the 28th verse of the 9th chapter. From whatever we've seen in the past few verses, one thing has been established. Krishna has got nothing to do with the physical. God has got nothing to do with the physical. What you do as puja, what you offer as naivedya, what name you call, whether you perform a yajna or you do an abhisheka, it doesn't matter. Offering is all about the mind. It's all about the feelings, the bhavam. So the impact of leading such a life of dedication will also be not merely in the physical, but will be in the mind, right? When the offering is dependent on the mind, the results of leading a life of such offering will also be in the mind. I may have narrated this episode earlier. I had heard this in one of the beautiful talks given by another Swamiji, I think from the Ramakrishna Mission, if I'm not wrong. There was once this Guruji, a Swamiji, who had many disciples and he was growing old. One of his devotees was a very rich man who had traveled many countries. He was on one of his international travels. He wanted to get something for his guru. He wanted to gift the guru something out of his love for his master. So during his travels, he buys a very expensive walking stick. Very carefully packs it. He carries it back to India with the hope that he will be able to offer it to his guru. He spends a lot of time in choosing it, and then it's pretty expensive, understandably. And then he gets it for his Swamiji. Clearly, he has done this out of his immense love and devotion for his guru. But then the guru is a very spiritual person who has no attachment to physical objects. So when he is gifted this expensive and exquisite walking stick, he looks at it and says, no, I don't want any of these objects. I don't accept gifts. Please don't give me this. Then the devotee pleads and he says, please, Guruji, you're getting gold. It will be useful to you. And, I've taken a lot of trouble in getting this for you. Please accept this as my offering of love. The guru tries to refuse, but then this devotee is constantly insisting. So the guru finds a beautiful opportunity there to convey a very profound message. So the guru says, okay, so now you've offered the stick to me, I'll accept it. And then he says, so the stick is mine now? And the disciple says, yes, Swamiji, I've offered it to you. It is yours. I got it only for you. Then the guru says, okay, now that the stick is mine, he says, I'm going to break it. He says, I'm going to break it now. And immediately the disciple says, no, master, please don't do that. It's such an expensive gift and I've taken so much trouble. I've spent so much time choosing the most beautiful one for you. Please don't break it. I got it with the hope that you'll use it. Then the guru says, see, so you have not offered it to me. Merely giving it to me is not an offering. Once you offer it, it becomes mine. It should not matter to you what I do with it. So when we say I am offering it to Swami, it also means becoming detached from what happens thereafter to the offering, right? What is the outcome of it? The disciple gave the guru a walking stick with an idea attached to it. Not a bad idea, but nevertheless an idea. And what was that idea? That the guru should be walking around with this walking stick and make use of the offering that he has given. But the guru was telling him, true offering to the Lord is when you give and thereafter it belongs to the Lord and it must not bother you what happens to it. This is not an attitude that comes overnight. But it will come when this attitude of offering everything to the Lord becomes a habit. Slowly it will come, right? The best example, the story that I narrated was the example. Definitely the disciple was making an offering. But that attitude of what happens to the mind when you make an offering, that had not yet set in. Going back to that interview of Ms. Charu Sinha, she gives an example when she was given a certain posting in this was probably in the early years of her career. She put so many processes in place in one of the postings that she was given. She had worked really hard to build a system and so that, it's things go on very smoothly. And like it happens, she gets a transfer after a few years. The officer who takes charge after her in that same posting, he systematically destroys and dismantles the whole system. And she says initially she felt so hurt and disturbed by it because she had put so much of her, time and interest into building that entire system. But then with time she realized that what she was doing was wrong. She had done her bit. She had offered it to Swami and there is nothing now to be attached to it. It is done. It's an offering. It has been made. Now it is up to Swami what he does with that. Such an attitude will come only when we first do our duty, then do it as an offering to Swami, and then eventually this attitude of detachment will come. Because the whole idea is we are trying to remove this attitude of doership from the mind. And for this, first we must do, right? The idea that, if I don't do, there will be no doership, it doesn't work like that. That would be tamas. Right? The sattvic state of not having doership can be achieved only through rajas. First, you must do, then do it as an offering, then detachment will eventually come. That is what Krishna says in the shloka. Evam, in this way, whatever he has said in the past two shlokas, mokshyase, you shall be freed, karma bandhanaihi, from the bonds of actions, shubha, ashubha phalaihi, in the form of good and evil results. For bondage to happen, you need a feature on both sides, right? If you have two surfaces that you want to stick to each other, there should be something that binds to the other on each surface. Like the best example I can think of is like Velcro, right? Or like a nut and a bolt, or a hook and a ring. How do we get bound? The feature that is in us, right? Just like a nut and a bolt, a hook and a ring, there is one feature in us and there is one feature in the actions. The feature in us that makes us get bound is raga and dvesha. The feature in karma that makes us get bound to it is shubha, ashubha, phalau, good and bad results. So the attitude of offering to God, what it does is it smoothens out this raga and dvesha. This peak and this trough of raga and dvesha is slowly over a period of time smoothened out. Karma will continue to have shubha and ashubha phalau. It will continue to have pleasant and unpleasant results. But that does not have any means to attach to your mind anymore. Right? The karma does not have a surface now that it can attach to. What happens then? Sannyasa yoga yuktatma. The mind steadfast in yoga of renunciation. When you offer every deed and thought to God, you become eventually a sannyasa yoga yuktatma. You have this feature in you, yoga yuktatma. You become attached to the path of spirituality and you don't get attached to these results. All these are reiterations of what Krishna spoke in earlier chapters, right? It's not anything new, where he described what is true sannyasa. I think somewhere in the third chapter he speaks about that. True sannyasa is not giving up action. He had made it very clear what has to be given up is not the duty, but the fruits of action. Not karma, but karma phala. In this portion of the Gita, Krishna is explaining how the act of doing everything as an offering makes you attain that state of true sannyasa. He then says, sannyasa yoga yuktatma, with a mind steadfast in the yoga of renunciation, vimuktaha, being liberated, mam upaishyasi, to me they shall come. That is what Krishna had said few shlokas back. You worship me, you reach me. And what he gave in the past few shlokas is that process, the details of how to worship him. Now let us look at whatever Krishna has said from the point of view of a skeptic, right? Whatever he has said, you worship me, you reach me, whatever you do it as an offering to me. Look at it from the point of view of somebody who's looking at Krishna as a skeptic, not as a devotee. Now, doesn't this appear to be favoritism? If you worship anyone else, you will get bound. If you worship me, then I will give you freedom. Doesn't this appear like somebody who is probably a megalomaniac? This seems like what happens with most leaders and patrons, isn't it? As long as you placate me, as long as you favor me, I will take care of you. You displease me, then you lose my favor. Is that how Krishna behaves? Is that the attitude or is that the nature of the Lord? Krishna clears that very misconception in the next shloka. We'll listen to it and we'll discuss about it. The next is the 29th shloka.
Samoham sarva bhuteshu namedveshyosti napriyaha. Ye bhajanti tu mam bhaktya mayi te teshu chapyaham.
The same am I to all beings. To me there is none hateful or dear, but those who worship me with devotion are in me and I am also in them. So that's the 29th verse of the 9th chapter. So before we could come to that conclusion that Krishna is also like any megalomaniac who favors those who praise him, as we had seen in, I think, the 4th chapter, Krishna said, he has created the varnas, the distinctions in classes among people, but he has done so by being equal and just. Like any neutral measuring instrument, it's the time of the pandemic, so we're surrounded by gadgets such as the temperature guns and the oximeters. The instrument doesn't show you as sick because it doesn't like you. Or it's practicing favoritism and so it shows you as being fine. It shows what is there. If there is temperature, it shows temperature. If your oxygen level is low, it shows the oxygen level to be low, right? And a better instrument is that which can retain this neutrality under different extreme conditions. In fact, Swami gives this very example in the Gita Vahini. Swami says, you know, the doctor may like you, may not like you, but the thermometer in the doctor's hand, that never lies. If you have temperature, it will show that you have temperature. And then Swami goes on to say, God is like that. He doesn't go by the externals. God sees past the physical and he sees the heart. And so his judgment is always right. That's exactly what Krishna says here. I am the same always. Samaha aham. I am the same. Sarva bhuteshu. To all beings. Name dveshyaha asti na priyaha. There is none who is detested, none who is dear. Ye bhajanti tu mam bhaktya. But whoever worships me with devotion, mayite, in me they exist, teshu cha api aham, and also in them I. What is the significance of this? As Swami would say, you look to me, I look to you. He says, ye bhajanti mam bhaktya, those who worship me with devotion, or your bhajanti means seek, who want to move closer to the Lord, right? Seek with devotion. Ye bhajanti mam bhaktya, who seek me with devotion, he says, they are in me, I am in them. Mayi te, teshu cha api aham. But here Krishna is talking about the mind of the devotees, right? Because if you really look at it, this can be said for the entire creation. The entire creation is in him and he is in the entire creation. And we've come across this statement a couple of times already in the Gita. But what Krishna is referring to here is about the mind, the approach of the devotee, right? Because the whole thing is happening in the mind, in the antakarana. Though all exist in God and he exists in all, this comes to the knowledge of only those who seek him. And this cannot be referred to as partiality. Swami conveys this same idea in Gita Vahini through a dialogue between Krishna and Arjuna. And I'll probably read out that before we conclude. Swami says in the Gita Vahini, and I quote, this raised some doubts in Arjuna's mind. He asked, Krishna, you say that you do not make any distinction, that you have neither friend nor foe. Why then are some happy and others unhappy? Some strong in body and mind and others weak and sickly, some poor and others rich. What is the reason behind all this? When you yourself are above any distinction of such type, why can't you keep all in the same condition? Observing facts as they are, it is difficult to believe that you look upon all without any partiality. Krishna laughed at this doubt that worried Arjuna. And he said, I give expression only to truth. I do not adjust my speech to your approval or disapproval. I am not elated when you approve or depressed when you disapprove. I am the same in all. But all are not the same in me. You have observed that during the cold month, villagers sit around a fire at night. But only those who sit near the fire get refreshed by the warmth. Those squatting far away have also to put up with the darkness. If people stay afar and complain that they don't receive the warmth and that they have to suffer darkness, can you describe it to the partiality of fire? It is meaningless to argue from this that fire treats different people differently. The splendor of the divine vision is akin to this. If you seek to earn it, you have to approach it and stay there. Everyone has equal right to do so and to feel the fire, so that it might illumine and warm even more. Fire is impartial in deriving its benefit and in making it grow into greater and greater capacity. There are differences. I am splendor. I have no partiality at all. All have equal chance, opportunity, and authority to experience me and derive bliss from me. Distinctions and differences arise as a result of the faults of the spiritual aspirants. They are not blemishes in me. End of quote. There cannot be a better example than that. Swami would tell this many times to us when we were students too. If you seek warmth, you must take the trouble of moving closer. You cannot stay where you are and say, the fire's warmth doesn't reach me, so the fire doesn't like me. Right? As Swami said in that thing. A few years back, we had shared a video of a Kodai session where Swami was talking to students. Swami was sitting on a chair. The students were huddled around him. At that time, Swami had made this point. He said, you see here, there are a few boys who are sitting in the first and second row. How did they come here in the first and second row and are enjoying being close to Swami? Because they wanted to sit near Swami, they quickly finished their food. They did not give much attention to what they were eating and came running and sat here. Swami says in that clip, because you had interest, you came closer to Swami. Right? So then you can enjoy the proximity. This was just a physical demonstration of what happens in the spiritual journey, right? This is not to compare Swami's students with other devotees, because we know devotees would come and sit at 4 in the morning and we would come much later and we would sit closer to Swami, right? This is not to be taken literally, but Swami was giving this very same example. If you have interest, you will become a sadhaka who will move closer to Swami, right? That's what he says here. Mayi te teshu cha api aham. In me they exist and also in them I exist. The more there is interest, the more closer we will move to the Lord, the more we will feel the truth of this statement. So I think we'll conclude with that and I'm running out of time. We'll continue the 9th chapter. Hopefully we'll complete it next week or maybe the week after that. There are about 3 or 4 shlokas to still complete. So do join me again next week, dear listeners, at 10 o'clock for the resumption of this beautiful pilgrimage, the triune pilgrimage of the Gita series. In a short while from now, you'll be joined by Brother Bishu for the next segment of the day. Till I meet you next time, take care, keep safe. Jai Sai Ram.